Though far milder now than it had been earlier, the wind nevertheless had dried the blood that had stained the stones, and darkness hid the residue. Still, Candy was sure he could find the killing place. He gingerly touched the pilaster high and low on all four faces, as if he expected a portion of it to be hot enough to sear his skin. But though he patiently traced the outlines of the rough stones and the mortar seams, too much time had passed. Even his exceptional talents could not extract his brother's lingering aura. He hurried along the cracked and canted walkway, out of the chilly night and into the stiflingly warm house again, into the kitchen, where his sisters were sitting on the blankets in the cat's corner. Verbena was behind Violet, a comb in one hand and a brush in the other, grooming her sister's flaxen hair. Candy said,
"Where's Samantha?"
Tilting her head, looking up at him perplexedly, Violet said, "I told you, dead."
"Where's the body?"
"Here," Violet said, making a sweeping gesture with both hands to indicate the quiescent feline sprawled and curled around her.
"Which one?"
Candy asked. Half of the creatures were so still that any of them might have been the dead one. "All," Violet said. "They're all Samantha now."
Candy had been afraid of that. Each time one of the cats died, the twins drew the rest of the pack into a circle, placed the corpse at the center, and without speaking, commanded the living to partake of the dead.
"Damn,"
Candy said. "Samantha still lives. She's still a part of us," Violet said. Her voice was as low and whispery as before, but dreamier than usual. "None of our pusses ever really leaves us. Part of him or her stays in each of us. And we're all stronger because of that, stronger and purer, and always together, always and forever."
Candy did not ask if his sisters had shared in the feast, for he already knew the answer. Violet licked the corner of her mouth as if remembering the taste, and her moist lips glistened. A moment later, Verbena's tongue slid across her lips, too. Sometimes Candy felt as if the twins were members of an entirely different species from him, for he could seldom fathom their attitudes and behavior. And when they looked at him, Verbena in perpetual silence, their faces and eyes revealed nothing of their thoughts or feelings. They were as inscrutable as the cats. He only dimly grasped the twins' bond with the cats. It was their blessed mother's gift to them, just as his many talents were his mother's generous bequest to him. So he did not question the rightness or wholesomeness of it. Still, he wanted to hit Violet because she hadn't saved the body for him. She had known Frank had touched it, that it could be of use to Candy, but she had not saved it until he'd awakened, had not come to wake him early. He wanted to smash her, but she was his sister, and he couldn't hurt his sisters. He had to provide for them, protect them. His mother was watching.
"The parts that couldn't be eaten?"
he asked, and Violet gestured toward the kitchen door. He switched on the outside light and stepped onto the back porch. Small knobs of bone and vertebrae were scattered like queerly shaped dice on the unpainted floorboards. Only two sides of the porch were open, the house angled around the other two flanks of it, and in the niche where the house walls met, Candy found a piece of Samantha's tail and scraps of fur jammed there by the night wind. The half-crushed skull was on the top step. He snatched it up and moved down onto the unmown lawn. The wind, which had been declining since late afternoon, suddenly stopped altogether. The cool air would have carried the faintest sound a great distance, but the night was hushed. Usually, Candy could touch an object and see who had recently handled it before him. Sometimes he could even see where some of the people had gone after putting the object down, and when he went looking for them, they were always to be found where his clairvoyance had led him. Frank had killed the cat, and Candy hoped that contact with the remains would spark an inner vision that would put him on his brother's trail again. Every speck of flesh had been stripped from Samantha's broken pate, and its contents had been emptied as well. Picked clean, licked smooth, dried by the wind, it might have been a portion of a fossil from a different age. Candy's mind was filled not with images of Frank, but of the other cats and Verbena and Violet. And finally he threw down the damaged skull in disgust. His frustration sharpened his anger. He felt the need rising in him. He dared not let the need bloom. But resisting it was infinitely harder than resisting the charms of women and other sins. He hated Frank. He hated him so much, so deeply, had hated him so constantly for 7 years, that he could not bear the thought that he had slept through an opportunity to destroy him. Need. He dropped to his knees on the weedy lawn. He fisted his hands and hunched his shoulders and clenched his teeth, trying to make a rock of himself, an unmovable mass that would not be swayed one inch by the most urgent need, not one hair's width by even the most dire necessity, the most demanding hunger, the most passionate craving. He prayed to his mother to give him strength. The wind began to pick up again, and he believed it was a devil wind that would blow him toward temptation, so he fell forward on the ground and dug his fingers into the yielding earth. And he repeated his mother's sacred name, Roselle, whispered her name furiously into the grass and dirt again and again, desperate to quell the germination of his dark need. Then he wept. Then he got up and went hunting. Frank went to a theater and sat through a movie, but was unable to concentrate on the story. He ate dinner at El Torito, though he didn't really taste the food. He just pushed down the enchiladas and rice as if feeding fuel to a furnace. For a couple of hours, he drove aimlessly back and forth across the middle and southern reaches of Orange County, staying on the move only because, for the time being, he felt safer when in motion. Finally, he returned to the motel. He kept probing at the dark wall in his mind, behind which his entire life was concealed. Diligently he sought the tiniest chink through which he might glimpse a memory. If he could find one crack, he was sure that the entire facade of amnesia would come tumbling down. But the barrier was smooth and flawless. When he switched off the lights, he could not sleep. The Santa Anas had abated. He could not blame his insomnia on the noisy winds. Although the amount of blood on the sheets had been minimal, and though it had dried since he'd awakened from his nap earlier in the day, he decided that the thought of lying in blood-stained bedclothes was preventing him from nodding off. He snapped on a lamp, stripped the bed, turned up the heat, stretched out in the darkness again, and tried to sleep without covers. No good. He told himself that his amnesia and the resultant loneliness and sense of isolation was keeping him awake. Although there was some truth in that, he knew that he was kidding himself. The real reason he could not sleep was fear. Fear of where he might go while sleepwalking. Fear of what he might do. Fear of what he might find in his hands when he woke up.
Derek slept in the other bed, snoring softly. Thomas couldn't sleep. He got up and stood by the window looking out. The moon was gone. The dark was very big. He didn't like the night. It scared him. He liked sunshine and flowers all bright, and grass looking green, and blue sky all over, so you felt like there was a lid on the world, keeping everything down here on the ground and in place. At night, all the colors were gone, and the world was empty, like somebody took the lid off and let in a lot of nothingness. And you looked up at all that nothingness, and you felt you might just float away like the colors, float up and away and out of the world. And then in the morning, when they put the lid back on, you wouldn't be here. You'd be out there somewhere, and you could never get back in again. Never. He put his fingertips against the window. The glass was cool. He wished he could sleep away the night. Usually he slept okay. Not tonight. He He was worried about Julie. Well, you always worried about her a little. A brother was supposed to worry. But this wasn't a little worry. This was a lot. It started just that morning. A funny feeling. Not funny ha-ha, funny strange. Funny scary. Something real bad's going to happen to Julie, the feeling said. Thomas got so upset, he tried to warn her. He TV'd a warning to her. They said the pictures and voices and music on the TV were sent through the air, which he first thought was a lie, that they were making fun of his being dumb, expecting him to believe anything. But then Julie said it was true, so sometimes he tried to TV his thoughts to her, because if you could send pictures and music and voices through the air, thoughts ought to be easy. Be careful, Julie, he TV'd. Look out, be careful. Something bad's going to happen. Usually, when he felt things about someone, that someone was Julie. He knew when she was happy or sad. When she was sick, he sometimes curled up on the bed and put his hands over his own belly. He always knew when she was coming to visit. He felt things about Bobby, too, not at first. When Julie first brought Bobby around, Thomas felt nothing, but slowly he felt more. Until now, he felt almost as much about Bobby as about Julie. He felt things about some other people, too, like Derek, like Gina, another Downs kid at the home, and like a couple of the aides, one of the visiting nurses. But he didn't feel half as much about them as he did about Bobby and Julie. He figured that maybe the more he loved somebody, the bigger he felt things, new things about them. Sometimes when Julie was worried about him, Thomas wanted real bad to tell her that he knew how she felt and that he was all right, because just knowing he understood would make her happier. But he didn't have the words. He couldn't explain how or why he sometimes felt other people's feelings, and he didn't want to try to tell them about it because he was afraid of looking dumb. He was dumb. He knew that. He wasn't as dumb as Derek, who was very nice, good to room with, but who was real slow. They sometimes said slow instead of dumb when they talked in front of you. Julie never did, Bobby never did, but some people said slow and thought you didn't get it. He got it. They had bigger words, too, and he really didn't understand those, but he sure understood slow. He didn't want to be dumb. Nobody gave him a choice. And sometimes he TV'd a message to God, asking God to make him not dumb anymore. But either God wanted him to stay dumb always and forever, but why? Or God just didn't get the messages. Julie didn't get the messages either. Thomas always knew when he got through to someone with a TV'd thought. He never got to Julie. But he could sometimes get through to Bobby, which was funny. Not ha-ha funny, strange funny, interesting funny. When Thomas TV'd a thought to Julie, Bobby sometimes got it instead, like this morning, when he TV'd a warning to Julie, something bad's going to happen, Julie, something real bad is coming. Bobby had picked it up. Maybe because Thomas and Bobby both loved Julie. Thomas didn't know. He couldn't figure. But it sure happened. Bobby tuned in. Now Thomas stood at the window in his pajamas and looked out at the scary night and felt the bad thing out there. Felt it like a ripple in his blood, like a tingle in his bones. The bad thing was far away, not anywhere near Julie, but coming. Today, during Julie's visit, Thomas wanted to tell her about the bad thing coming, but he couldn't find a way to say it and make sense, and he was scared of sounding dumb. Julie and Bobby knew he was dumb, sure, but he hated to sound dumb in front of them, to remind them how dumb he was. Every time he almost started to tell her about the bad thing, he just forgot how to use words. He had the words in his head, all lined up in a row, ready to say, but then suddenly they were mixed up, and he couldn't make them get back in the right order, so he couldn't say the words because they'd just be words without meaning anything, and he'd look really, really dumb. Besides, He didn't know what to tell her the bad thing was. He thought maybe it was a person, a real terrible person out there, going to do something to Julie, but it didn't exactly feel like a person. Partly a person, but something else. Something that made Thomas feel cold, not just on his outside, but on his inside, too, like standing in a winter wind and eating ice cream at the same time. He shivered. He didn't want to get these ugly feelings about whatever was out there, but he couldn't just go back to bed and tune out either, because the more he felt about the faraway bad thing, the better he could warn Julie and Bobby when the thing wasn't so far away anymore. Behind him, Derek murmured in a dream. The home was real quiet. All the dumb people were deep asleep, except Thomas. Sometimes he liked to be awake when everyone else wasn't. Sometimes that made him feel smarter than all of them put together, seeing things they couldn't see and knowing things they couldn't know because they were asleep and he wasn't. He stared at the nothingness of night. He put his forehead against the glass. For Julie's sake, he reached into the nothingness, toward the far away. He opened himself to the feelings, to the ripple tingle. A big, ugly, nasty hit him, like a wave. It came out of the night and hit him, and he stumbled back from the window and fell on his butt beside the bed, and then he couldn't feel the bad thing at all. It was gone. But what he had felt was so big and so ugly that his heart was pounding, and he could hardly breathe. And right away he TV'd to Bobby, "Run! Go! Get away! Save Julie! The bad thing's coming! The bad thing! Run! Run!" The dream was filled with the music of Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade, although, like everything in dreams, the song was indefinably different from the real tune. Bobby was in a house that was at once familiar yet totally strange, and somehow he knew it was the seaside bungalow to which he and Julie were going to retire young. He drifted into the living room, over a dark Persian carpet, past comfortable-looking upholstered chairs, a huge old Chesterfield with rounded back and thick cushions, a Ruhlmann cabinet with bronze panels, an Art Deco lamp, and overflowing bookshelves. The music was coming from outside, so he went out there. He enjoyed the easy transitions of the dream, moving through a door without opening it, crossing a wide porch and descending wooden stairs without ever quite lifting a foot. The sea rumbled to one side, and the phosphorescent foam of the breakers glowed faintly in the night. Under a palm tree in the sand, with a scattering of shells around it, stood a Wurlitzer 950, ablaze with gold and red light, bubble tubes percolating, gazelles perpetually leaping, figures of Pan perpetually piping, record-changing mechanism gleaming like real silver, and a large black platter spinning on the turntable. Bobby felt as if Moonlight Serenade would go on forever, which would have been fine with him, because he had never been more mellow, more at peace, and he sensed that Julie had come out of the house behind him, that she was waiting on the damp sand near the water's edge, and that she wanted to dance with him. So he turned, and there she was, exotically illuminated by the Wurlitzer. And he took a step toward her. "Run! Go! Get away! Save Julie! The bad thing's coming! The bad thing! Run! Run!" The indigo ocean suddenly leapt as if under the lash of a storm. The spume exploded into the night air. Hurricane winds shook the palms. "The bad thing! Run! Run!" The world tilted. Bobby stumbled toward Julie. The sea surged up around her. It wanted her. It was going to seize her. It was water with a will, a thinking sea with a malevolent consciousness gleaming darkly in its depth. "The bad thing." The Glenn Miller tune speeded up, whirling at double time. "The bad thing." The soft, romantic light from the Wurlitzer flamed brighter, stung his eyes, yet did not drive back the night. It was radiating light as if the door of hell had been opened, but the darkness around him only intensified, yielding nothing to that supernatural blaze. "The bad thing! The bad thing!" The world tilted again, heaved and rolled. Bobby staggered across the carnival ride beach toward Julie, who seemed unable to move. She was being swallowed by the churning, oil-black sea. "The bad thing! The bad thing! The bad thing!" With a hard crack of riven stone, the sky split above them, but no lightning stabbed out of the crumbling vault. Geysers of sand erupted around Bobby. Inky water exploded out of sudden gaping holes in the beach. He looked back. The bungalow was gone. The sea rose on all sides. The beach was dissolving under his feet. Screaming, Julie disappeared under the water. The bad thing, the bad thing, the bad thing, the bad thing! A 20-foot wave loomed over Bobby. It broke. He was swept away. He tried to swim. The flesh on his arms and legs bubbled and blistered and began to peel off, revealing glints of ice-white bone. The midnight seawater was an acid. His head went under. He gasped, broke the surface, but the corrosive sea had already kissed away his lips, and he felt his gums receding from his teeth, and his tongue turned to rancid mush in the salty rush of caustic brine that he had swallowed. Even the spray-filled air was erosive, eating away his lungs in an instant, so when he tried to breathe, he could not. He went down, flailing at the waves with arms and hands that were only bone, caught in an undertow, sucked into everlasting darkness, disillusion, oblivion. Bad thing! Bobby sat straight up in bed. He was screaming, but no cry issued from him. When he realized he'd been dreaming, he stopped trying to scream. And finally a low, miserable sound escaped him. He'd thrown off the sheets. He sat on the edge of the bed, feet on the floor, both hands on the mattress, steadying himself as if he was still on that heaving beach or struggling to swim in those roiling tides. The green numbers of the projection clock glowed faintly on the ceiling, 2:43. For a while the drum-loud thud of his own heart filled him with sound from within, and he was deaf to the outer world. But after a few seconds, he heard Julie breathing steadily, rhythmically, and he was surprised that he had not awakened her. Evidently, he had not been thrashing in his sleep. The panic that infused the dream had not entirely left him. His anxiety began to swell again, partly because the room was as lightless as that devouring sea. Afraid of waking Julie, he did not switch on the bedside lamp. As soon as he was able to stand, he got up and circled the bed in the perfect blackness. The bathroom was on her side, but a clear path was provided, and he found his way, as he had on countless other nights, without difficulty, guided both by experience and instinct. He eased the door shut behind him, switched on the lights. For a moment, the fluorescent brilliance prevented him from looking into the glary surface of the mirror above the double sinks. When at last he regarded his reflection, he saw that his flesh had not been eaten away. The dream had been frighteningly vivid, unlike anything he'd known before. In some strange way, it had been even more real than waking life, with intense colors and sounds that pushed through his slumbering mind with a fulgurant dazzle of light along the filament of an incandescent bulb. Though aware that it had been a dream, he had half feared that the nightmare ocean had left its corrosive mark on him, even after he woke. Shuddering, he leaned against the counter. He turned on the cold water, bent forward, and splashed his face. Dripping, he looked at his reflection again and met his eyes. He whispered to himself, "What the hell was that?"
Candy prowled. The eastern end of the Pollard family's two-acre property dropped into a canyon. The walls were steep, composed mostly of dry, crumbling soil, veined in places by pink and gray shale. Only the expansive root systems of the hardy desert vegetation, chaparral, thick clumps of bunch grass, pampas grass, scattered mesquite, kept the slopes from eroding extensively in every heavy rain. A few eucalyptuses, laurels, and melaleucas grew on the walls of the canyon, and where the floor was broad enough, melaleucas and California live oaks sank roots deep into the earth along the runoff channel. That channel was only a dry stream bed now, but during a heavy rain it overflowed. Fleet and silent in spite of his size, Candy followed the canyon eastward, moving upslope, until he came to a junction with another declivity that was too narrow to be called a canyon. There he turned north. The land continued to climb, though not as steeply as before. Sheer walls soared on both sides of him, and in places the passage was nearly pinched off, narrowing to only a couple of feet. Brittle tumbleweeds blown into the ravine by the wind had collected in mounds at some of those choke points, and they scratched Candy as he pushed through them. Without even a fragment moon, the night was unusually dark at the bottom of that fissure in the land, but he seldom stumbled and never hesitated. His gifts did not include superhuman vision. He was as blinded by lightlessness as anyone. However, even in the blackest night, he knew when obstacles lay before him, sensed the contours of the land so well that he could proceed with sure-footed confidence. He did not know how this sixth sense served him, and he did nothing to engage it. He simply had an uncanny awareness of his relationship with his surroundings, knew his place at all times, much as the best high-wire walkers, though blindfolded, could proceed with self-assurance along a taut line above the upturned faces of a circus crowd. This was another gift from his mother. All of her children were gifted, but Candy's talents exceeded those of Violet, Verbena, and Frank. The narrow passage opened into another canyon, and Candy turned east again, along a rocky runoff channel, hurrying now as his need grew. Though ever more widely separated, houses were still perched high above on the canyon rim. Their bright windows were too far away to illuminate the ground before him, but now and then he glanced up, longingly, because within those homes was the blood he needed. God had given Candy a taste for blood, made him a predator, and therefore God was responsible for whatever Candy did. His mother had explained all of that long ago. God wanted him to be selective in his killing, but when Candy was unable to restrain himself, the ultimate blame was God's, for he had instilled the blood lust in Candy, but had not provided him with the strength to control it. Like that of all predators, Candy's mission was to thin the sick and the weak from the herd. In his case, morally degenerate members of the human herd were the intended prey, thieves, liars, cheats, adulterers. Unfortunately, he did not always recognize sinners when he met them. Fulfilling his mission had been far easier when his mother had been alive, for she had no trouble spotting the blighted souls for him. Tonight he would try, as best he could, to confine his killing to wild animals. Slaughtering people, especially close to home, was chancy. It might bring him under the eye of the police. He could risk killing locals only when they had crossed the family in some way and simply could not be allowed to live. If he was unable to satisfy his need with animals, he would go somewhere, anywhere, and kill people. His mother up there in heaven would be angry with him and disappointed by his lack of control, but God would not be able to blame him. After all, he was only what God had made him. With the lights of the last house well behind him, he stopped in a grove of melaleucas. The day's strong winds had drained out of the high hills down through the canyons and out to sea. Currently, the air seemed utterly still. Drooping trailers hung from the branches of the melaleucas, and every long, blade-sleek leaf was motionless. His eyes had adapted to the darkness. The trees were silver in the dim starlight, and their cascading trailers contributed to an illusion that he was surrounded by a silent waterfall, or frozen in a paperweight blizzard. He could even make out the ragged scrolls of bark that curled away from the trunks and limbs in the perpetual peeling process that lent a unique beauty to the species. He could not see any prey. He could hear no furtive movement of wildlife in the brush. However, he knew that many small creatures, filled with warm blood, were huddled nearby in burrows and secret nests, in drifts of old leaves and in the sheltered niches of rocks. The very thought of them made him half mad with hunger. He held his arms out in front of him, palms facing away from him, fingers spread. Blue light, the shade of pale sapphire, faint as the glow of a quarter moon, perhaps a second in duration, pulsed from his hands. The leaves trembled, and the sparse bunch grass stirred. Then all was still as darkness reclaimed the canyon floor. Again blue light shone forth from his hands, as if they were hooded lanterns from which the shutters had been briefly lifted. This time The light was twice as bright as before, a deeper blue, and it lasted perhaps 2 seconds. The leaves rustled, and a few of the drooping trailers swayed, and the grass shivered for 30 or 40 feet in front of him. Disturbed by those queer vibrations, something scurried toward Candy, started past him. With that special sense of his surroundings that did not rely on sight or sound or smell, he reached to his left and snatched at the unseen darting creature. His reflexes were as uncanny as anything else about him, and he seized his prey, a field mouse. For an instant it froze in terror, then it squirmed in his grasp, but he held fast to it. His power had no effect on living things. He could not stun his prey with the telekinetic energy that radiated from his open palms. He could not draw them forth or call them to him, only frighten them out of hiding. He could have shattered one of the Melaleucas or sent geysers of dirt and stones into the air, but no matter how hard he strained, he could not have stirred one hair on the mouse by using just his mind. He didn't know why he was hampered by that limitation. Violet and Verbena, whose gifts were not half as impressive as his, seemed to have power only over living things, smaller animals like the cats. Plants bent to Candy's will, of course, and sometimes insects, but nothing with a mind. Not even something with a mind as weak as that of a mouse. Kneeling under the silvery trees, he was swaddled in gloom so deep that he could see nothing of the mouse except its dimly gleaming eyes. He brought the fist-wrapped creature to his mouth. It made a thin, terrified sound, more of a peep than a squeal. He bit off its head, spat it out, and fastened his lips upon the torn neck. The blood was sweet, but there was too little of it. He cast the dead rodent aside and raised his arms again, palms out, fingers spread. This time the splash of spectral light was an intense, electric, sapphire blue. Although it was of no greater duration than before, its effect was startlingly greater. A half-dozen waves of vibrations, each a fraction of a second apart, slammed up the inclined floor of the canyon. The tall trees shook, and the hundreds of drooping trailers lashed the air, and the leaves thrashed with a sound like swarms of bees. Pebbles and smaller stones were flung up from the ground, and loose rocks rattled against one another. Every blade of bunch grass stood up stiff and straight like hair on a frightened man's nape, and a few clumps tore out of the soil and tumbled away into the night, along with showers of dead leaves, as if a wind had captured them. But no wind disturbed the night. Only the brief burst of sapphire light and the powerful vibrations that accompanied it. Wildlife erupted from concealment, and some of the animals streamed toward him, heading down the canyon. He had learned long ago that they never recognized his scent as that of a human being. They were as likely to flee toward him as away from him. Either he had no scent that they could detect, or they smelled something wild in him. Something more like themselves than like a human being, and in their panic they did not realize that he was a predator. They were visible at best as shapeless dark forms streaking past him, like shadows flung off by a spinning lamp. But he also sensed them with his psychic gift. Coyotes loped by, and a panicked raccoon brushed against his leg. He did not reach out for those because he wanted to avoid being badly clawed or bitten. At least a double score of mice streamed within reach as well, but he wanted something more full of life, heavy, with blood. He snatched at what he thought was a squirrel, missed, but a moment later seized a rabbit by its hind legs. It shrieked. It thrashed with its less formidable forepaws, but he got a hold of those too, not only immobilizing the creature, but paralyzing it with fear. He held it up to his face. Its fur had a dusty, musky smell. Its red eyes glistened with terror. He could hear its thunderous heart. He bit into its throat. The fur, hide, and muscle resisted his teeth, but blood flowed. The rabbit twitched, not in an attempt to escape, but as if to express its resignation to its fate. They were slow spasms, strangely sensuous, as if the creature almost welcomed death. Over the years, Candy had seen this behavior in countless small animals, especially in rabbits, and he always thrilled to it, for it gave him a heady sense of power, made him feel as one with the fox and the wolf. The spasms ceased, and the rabbit went limp in his hands. Though it was still alive, it had acknowledged the imminence of death, and had entered a trance-like state, in which it evidently felt no pain. This seemed to be a grace that God bestowed on small prey. Kendi bit into its throat again, harder this time, deeper, then bit again, deeper still, and the life of the rabbit spurted and bubbled into his greedy mouth. Far away in another canyon, a coyote howled. It was answered by others in its pack. A chorus of eerie voices rose and fell and rose again, as if the coyotes were aware that they were not the only hunters in the night, as if they smelled the fresh kill. When he had supped, Candy cast the drained corpse aside. His need was still great. He would have to break open the blood reservoirs within more rabbits or squirrels before his thirst was slaked. He got to his feet and headed farther up into the canyon, where the wildlife had not been disturbed by his first use of the power, where creatures of many kinds waited in their burrows and hidey holes to be harvested. The night was deep and bountiful.
Maybe it was just Monday morning blues. Maybe it was the bruised sky and the promise of rain that formed her mood. Or maybe she was tense and sour because the violent events at Decadine were only 4 days in the past, and therefore still too fresh. But for some reason, Julie did not want to take on this Frank Pollard's case, or any other new case for that matter. They had a few ongoing security contracts with firms they had served for years, and she wanted to stick to that comfortable, familiar business. Most of the work they did was about as risky as going to the supermarket for a quart of milk, but danger was a potential of the job, and the degree of danger in each new case was unknown. If a frail, elderly lady had come to them on Monday morning seeking help in finding a lost cat, Julie probably would have regarded her as a menace on a par with an axe-wielding psychopath. She was edgy. After all, if luck had not been with them last week, Bobby would now be 4 days dead. Sitting forward in her chair, leaning over her sturdy metal and formica desk, arms crossed on the green felt blotter, Julie studied Pollard. He could not meet her eyes, and that evasion aroused her suspicion in spite of his harmless, even appealing, appearance. He looked as if he ought to have a Vegas comedian's name, Shecky, Buddy, something like that. He was about 30 years old, 5'10", maybe 180 pounds, which on him was 30 pounds too much. However, it was his face that was most suited for a career in comedy. Except for a couple of curious scratches that were mostly healed, it was a pleasant mug. Open, kind, round enough to be jolly, deeply dimpled. A permanent flush tinted his cheeks, as if he'd been standing in the Arctic wind for most of his life. His nose was reddish, too, apparently not from too great a fondness for booze, but from having been broken a few times. It was lumpish enough to be amusing, but not sufficiently squashed to make him look like a thug. Shoulders slumped, he sat in one of the two leather and chrome chairs in front of Julie's desk. His voice was soft and pleasant, almost musical. "I need help. I don't know where else to go for it." In spite of his comedic looks, his manner was bleak. Though it was mellifluous, his voice was heavy with despair and weariness. With one hand, he periodically wiped his face as if pulling off cobwebs, then peered at his hand with puzzlement each time it came away empty. The backs of his hands were marked with scabbed-over scratches, too, a couple of which were slightly swollen and inflamed. "But frankly," he said, "seeking help from private detectives seems ridiculous. As if this isn't real life but a TV show." "Oh, I've got heartburn, so it's real life all right," Bobby said. He was standing at one of the big sixth-floor windows that faced out toward the mist-obscured sea and down on the nearby buildings of Fashion Island, the Newport Beach shopping center adjacent to the office tower in which Dakota and Dakota had leased a 7-room suite. He turned from the view, leaned against the sill, and extracted a roll of Rolaids from the pocket of his ultra-suede jacket. TV detectives never suffer heartburn, dandruff, and the heartbreak of psoriasis. Mr. Pollard, Julie said, I'm sure Mr. Karagiosis has explained to you that, strictly speaking, we aren't private detectives. Yes. We're security consultants. We primarily work with corporations and private institutions. We have 11 employees with sophisticated skills and years of security experience, which is a lot different from the one-man PI fantasies on TV. We don't shadow men's wives to see if they're being unfaithful, and we don't do divorce work or any of the other things that people usually come to private detectives for. Mr. Karagiosis explained that to me, Pollard said, looking down at his hands, which were clenched on his thighs. From the sofa to the left of the desk, Clint Karagiosis said, Frank told me his story, and I really think you ought to hear why he needs us. Julie noted that Clint had used the would-be client's first name, which he had never done before during 6 years with Dakota and Dakota. Clint was solidly built, 5'8", 160 pounds. He looked as though he had once been an inanimate assemblage of chunks of granite and slabs of marble, flint and fieldstone, slate and iron and lodestone, which some alchemist had transmuted into living flesh. His broad countenance, though handsome enough, also looked as if it had been chiseled from rock. In a search for a sign of weakness in his face, one could say only that, though strong, some features were not as strong as others. He had a rock-like personality, too, steady, reliable, imperturbable. Few people impressed Clint, and fewer still pierced his reserve and elicited more than a polite, business-like response from him. His use of the client's first name seemed to be a subtle expression of sympathy for Pollard and a vote of confidence in the truthfulness of whatever tale the man had to tell. If Clint thinks this is something for us, that's good enough for me, Bobby said. What's your problem, Frank? Julie was not impressed that Bobby had used the client's first name so immediately, casually. Bobby liked everyone he met, at least until they emphatically proved themselves unworthy of being liked. In fact, you had to stab him in the back repeatedly, virtually giggling with malice, before he would finally and regretfully consider the possibility that maybe he shouldn't like you. Sometimes she thought she had married a big puppy that was pretending to be human. Before Pollard could begin, Julie said, One thing first. If we decide to accept your case, and I stress the if, we aren't cheap. That's no problem, Pollard said. He lifted a leather flight bag from the floor at his feet. It was one of two he'd brought with him. He put it on his lap and unzippered it. He withdrew a couple of packs of currency and put them on the desk, 20s and 100s. As Julie took the money to inspect it, Bobby pushed away from the windowsill and went to Pollard's side. He looked down into the flight bag and said, It's crammed full. $140,000, Pollard said. Upon quick inspection, the money on the desk did not appear to be counterfeit. Julie pushed it aside and said, Mr. Pollard, are you in the habit of carrying so much cash? I don't know, Pollard said. You don't know? I don't know, he said miserably. He literally doesn't know, Clint said. Hear him out. In a voice at once subdued, yet heavy with emotion, Pollard said, You've got to help me find out where I go at night. What in God's name am I doing when I should be sleeping? Hey, this sounds interesting, Bobby said, sitting down on one corner of Julie's desk. Bobby's boyish enthusiasm made Julie nervous. He might commit them to Pollard before they knew enough to be sure that it was wise to take the case. She also didn't like him sitting on her desk. Just didn't seem businesslike. She felt that it gave the prospective client an impression of amateurism. From the sofa, Clint said, Should I start the tape? Definitely, Bobby said. Clint was holding a compact, battery-powered tape recorder. He flicked the switch and set the recorder on the coffee table in front of the sofa, with the built-in microphone aimed at Pollard, Julie, and Bobby. The slightly chubby, round-faced man looked up at them. The rings of bluish skin around his eyes, the watery redness of the eyes themselves, and the paleness of his lips belied any image of robust health to which his ruddy cheeks might have lent credence. A hesitant smile flickered across his mouth. He met Julie's eyes for no more than a second, looked down at his hands again. He seemed frightened, beaten, altogether pitiable. In spite of herself, she felt a pang of sympathy for him. As Pollard began to speak, Julie sighed and slumped back in her chair. 2 minutes later, she was leaning forward again, listening intently to Pollard's soft voice. She did not want to be fascinated, but she was. Even phlegmatic Clint Karagiosis, hearing the story for the second time, was obviously captivated by it. If Pollard was not a liar or a raving lunatic, and most likely he was both, then he was caught up in events of an almost supernatural nature. Julie did not believe in the supernatural. She tried to remain skeptical, but Pollard's demeanor and evident conviction persuaded her against her will. Bobby began making holy gee gosh wow sounds and slapping the desk in astonishment at the revelation of each new twist in the tale. When the client... No, Pollard, not the client. He wasn't their client yet. Pollard. When Pollard told them about waking in a motel room Thursday afternoon with blood on his hands, Bobby blurted, "We'll take the case." "Bobby, wait," Julie said. "We haven't heard everything Mr. Pollard came to tell us. We shouldn't..." "Yeah, Frank," Bobby said. "Oh, what the hell happened then?" Julie said, "What I mean is, we have to hear his whole story before we can possibly know whether or not we can help him." "Oh, we can help him, all right," Bobby said. "Bobby," she said firmly, "could I see you alone for a moment?" She got up, crossed the office, opened the door to the adjoining bathroom, and turned on the light in there. Bobby said, "Be right back, Frank." He followed Julie into the bathroom, closing the door behind them. She switched on the ceiling exhaust fan to help muffle their voices and spoke in a whisper, "What's wrong with you?" "Well, I have flat feet, no arches at all, and I've got that ugly mole in the middle of my back." "You're impossible! Flat feet and a mole are too many faults for you to handle? You're a hard woman." The room was small. They were standing between the sink and the toilet, almost nose to nose. He kissed her forehead. "Bobby, for God's sake, you just told Pollard we'll take his case. Maybe we won't." "Oh, why wouldn't we? It's fascinating." "Well, for one thing, he sounds like a nut." "No, he doesn't. He says some strange power caused that car to disintegrate, blew out streetlights, strange flute music, mysterious blue lights. The guy's been reading the National Enquirer too long." "But that's just it. A true nut would already be able to explain what happened to him. He'd claim he met God or Martians. This guy is baffled, looking for answers. That strikes me as a sane response. Besides, we're in business, Bobby. Business! Not for fun, for money. We're not a couple of damned hobbyists." "Well, he's got money. He saw it." "What if it's hot money? Frank's no thief." "Oh, you know him less than an hour, and you're sure he's no thief. You're so trusting, Bobby." "Thank you." "It wasn't a compliment. How can you do the kind of work you do and be so trusting?" He grinned. "Well, I trusted you, and that turned out okay." She refused to be charmed. "He says he doesn't know where he got the money. And just for the sake of argument, let's say we buy that part of the story. And let's also say you're right about him not being a thief. So maybe he's a drug dealer or something else. There's 1,000 ways it could be hot money without being stolen. And if we find out that it's hot, we can't keep what he pays us. We'll have to turn it over to the cops. We'll have wasted our time and energy. Besides, it's going to be messy." "Why do you say that?" he asked. "Why do I say that? He just told you about waking up in a motel room with blood all over his hands. Now keep your voice down. You might hurt his feelings." "Oh, God forbid. Remember, there was no body. It must have been his own blood." Frustrated, she said, "How do we know there was no body? Because he says there wasn't? He might be such a nutcase that he wouldn't even notice the body if he stepped in its steaming bowels and stumbled over its decapitated head." "Oh, what a vivid image." "Bobby, he says maybe he clawed it himself, but that's not very damned likely. Probably some poor woman, some innocent girl, maybe even a child, a helpless schoolgirl, was attacked by that man, dragged into his car, raped and beaten and raped again, forced to perform every humiliating act a perverse mind could imagine, then driven to some lonely desert canyon, maybe tortured with needles and knives and God knows what, then clubbed to death and pitched naked into a dry wash where coyotes are even now chewing on the softer parts of her with flies crawling in and out of her open mouth." "Julie, you're forgetting something." "What?" I'm the one with the overactive imagination. She laughed. She couldn't help it. She wanted to thump his skull hard enough to knock some sense into him, but she laughed instead and shook her head. He kissed her cheek, then reached for the doorknob. She put her hand on his. Promise, we won't take the case until we've heard his whole story and have time to think about it. All right. They returned to the office. Beyond the windows, the sky resembled a sheet of steel that had been scorched black in places, with a few scattered incrustations of mustard-yellow corrosion. Rain had not begun to fall, but the air seemed tense in expectation of it. The only lights in the room were two brass lamps on tables that flanked the sofa, and a silk-shaded brass floor lamp in one corner. The overhead fluorescents were not on, because Bobby hated the glare and believed that an office should be as cozily lighted as a den in a private home. Julie thought an office should look and feel like an office, but she humored Bobby and usually left the fluorescents off. Now, as the oncoming storm darkened the day, she wanted to switch on the overheads and chase away the shadows that had begun to gather in those corners, untouched by the amber glow of the lamps. Frank Pollard was still in his chair, staring at the framed posters of Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, and Uncle Scrooge that adorned the walls. They were another burden under which Julie labored. She was a fan of Warner Brothers cartoons because they had a harder edge than Disney's creations, and she owned videotape collections of them, plus a couple of animation cells of Daffy Duck. But she kept that stuff at home. Bobby brought his Disney cartoon characters into the office because, he said, they relaxed him, made him feel good, and helped him to think. No clients ever questioned their professional abilities merely because of the unconventional artwork on their walls, but she still worried about what they might think. She went behind her desk again, and again Bobby perched on it. After winking at Julie, Bobby said, "Frank, I was premature in accepting the case. We really can't make that decision until we've heard your whole story." "Oh, sure," Frank said, looking quickly at Bobby, at Julie, then down at his scratched hands, which were now clutching the open flight bag. That's perfectly understandable." "Of course it is," Julie said. Clint switched on the tape recorder again. Exchanging the flight bag on his lap for the one on the floor, Pollard said, "I should give you these things." He unzippered the second satchel and withdrew a plastic bag that contained a small portion of the handsful of black sand he'd been clutching when he had awakened after his brief sleep Thursday morning. He also withdrew the bloody shirt he had been wearing when he had arisen from his even shorter nap later the same day. "I saved them because, well, they seemed like evidence, clues. Maybe they'll help you figure out what's going on, what I've done." Bobby accepted the shirt and the sand, examined them briefly, then put them on the desk beside him. Julie noted that the shirt had been thoroughly saturated with blood, not merely spotted. Now the dry, brownish stains made the material stiff. "So you were in the motel Thursday afternoon," Bobby prompted. Pollard nodded. "Nothing much happened that night. I went to a movie. Couldn't get interested in it. Drove around a while. I was tired, real tired, in spite of the nap, but I couldn't sleep at all. I was afraid to sleep. Next morning I moved to another motel." "When did you finally sleep again?" Julie asked. "Next evening." "Friday evening, that was?" "Yeah. I tried to stay awake with lots of coffee. Sat at the counter in the little restaurant attached to the motel and drank coffee until I started to float off the stool. Stomach got so acidic I had to stop. Went back to my room. Every time I started nodding off, I went for a walk. But it was pointless. I couldn't stay awake forever. I was coming apart at the seams. I had to get some rest. So I went to bed shortly past 8 that evening, fell asleep instantly. Didn't wake up until 5:30 in the morning." "Saturday morning?" "Yeah." "And everything was okay?" Bobby asked. "Well, at least there was no blood. But there was something else." They waited. Pollard licked his lips, nodded, as if confirming to himself his willingness to continue. See, I'd gone to bed in my boxer shorts, but when I woke up, I was fully clothed. So you were sleepwalking and you dressed in your sleep, Julie said. But the clothes I was wearing weren't any I'd seen before, Julie blinked. Excuse me? They weren't the clothes I was wearing when I came to in that alleyway two nights before, and they weren't the clothes I bought at the mall on Thursday morning. Whose clothes were they? Bobby asked. Oh, they must be mine, Pollard said, because they fit me too well to belong to anyone else. They fit perfectly. Even the shoes fit perfectly. I couldn't have lifted that outfit from somebody else and been lucky enough to have it all fit so well. Bobby slipped off the desk and began to pace. So what are you saying? That you left that motel in your underwear, went out to some store, bought clothes, and nobody objected to your immodesty or even questioned you about it? Shaking his head, Pollard said, I don't know. Clint Caragiosa said, well, he could have dressed in his room while sleepwalking, then went out, bought other clothes, changed into them. Well, why would he do that? Julie asked. Clint shrugged. I'm just offering a possible explanation. Mr. Pollard, Bobby said, why would you have done something like that? I don't know. Pollard had used those three words so often that he was wearing them out. Each time he repeated them, his voice seemed softer and fuzzier than before. I don't think I did. It doesn't feel right, as an explanation, I mean. Besides, I didn't fall asleep in the motel until after 8 o'clock. I probably couldn't have gotten up again, gone out, and bought clothes before the stores closed. Well, some places are open till 10 o'clock, Clint said. There was a narrow window of opportunity, Bobby agreed. I don't think I would have broken into a store after hours, Pollard said, or stolen the clothes. I don't think I'm a thief. Oh, we know you're not a thief, Bobby said. We don't know any such thing, Julie said sharply. Bobby and Clint looked at her, but Pollard continued to stare at his hands, too shy or confused to defend himself. She felt like a bully for having questioned his honesty, which was nuts. They knew nothing about him. Hell, if he was telling the truth, he knew nothing about himself. Julie said, listen, whether he bought or stole the clothes is not the point here. I can't accept either. At least not with our current scenario. It's just too outrageous. The man going to a mall or Kmart or someplace in his underwear, outfitting himself while he's sleepwalking? Could he do all that and not wake up and appear to be awake to other people? I don't think so. I don't know anything about sleepwalking, but if we research it, I don't think we'll find such a thing as possible. Of course, it wasn't just the clothes, Clint said. Not just the clothes, Pollard said. When I woke up, there was a large paper bag on the bed beside me, like one of those you get in a supermarket if you don't want plastic. I looked inside, and it was full of money. More cash. How much? Bobby asked. I don't know. A lot. You didn't count it? It's back at the motel where I'm staying now. The new place. I keep moving. I feel safer that way. Anyway, you can count it later if you want. I tried to count it, but I've lost my ability to do even simple arithmetic. Yeah, I know. That sounds screwy, but it's what happened. Couldn't add numbers. I keep trying, but numbers just don't mean much to me anymore. He lowered his head, put his face in his hands. First, I lost my memory. Now I'm losing essential skills like math. I feel as if I'm coming apart, dissolving, until there's going to be none of me left, just a body.